Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find 3 separate speaker feeds with over 200 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Anne.
Hi, everybody. My name's Anne. I'm a compulsive overeater and a bulimic.
Hi, Anne.
Welcome to the newcomer. I hope you stay here. It's a wonderful place. And also congratulations to all the birthday people. Yeah, that candle totally reminds me of a purple cake. That's why I got it. And I also got it, Francine, because it's huge, like your heart. And you have meant so much to me in this program. Francine and I have been working the 4-step for, I guess about 6 months now in the 12 and 12, where they ask you all the questions, and we've been meeting weekly. It's really opened me up as a person, and I believe you as well. And, you know, that's part of the miracle of this program is, you know, we get to reveal ourselves. And I don't know about you, but I don't come from a place where I'm easily revealed. I just don't. That's not who I am. That's who I'm becoming thanks to this program. First of all, I want to thank Chase so much for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak at a 12-step meeting. I am a multiple addicted person. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous for the past almost 21 years now. And I'm also involved in Al-Anon, and I'm grateful for all the programs that I'm in. I pray that I speak from my heart and not from my ego and my head. I'm very, very nervous. This room means a whole lot to me because this is the room that I came into. I had about 10 years abstinence of long-term abstinence, and then I went out and thought I had cured myself, and I struggled greatly. As you did, I heard that you were in Alcoholics Anonymous as well. And I thought because I had all these years in sobriety that, you know, my ego, that it was too hard for me to come back. So it was really difficult to come back the second time around. But when I came to this meeting, people were here with open arms, like Leslie and Francine and Chase and Mike and so many of you in this room. So I truly love this room. So what does being a bulimic and a compulsive overeater mean? And that for me included binging, starving, purging, eating out of garbage cans, lying, stealing, cheating, dieting, exercising, of course, using laxatives, and being so consumed with myself that I had lost the sunlight of the spirit that I call. I was so obsessed with my body that, you know, my whole world revolved around how I looked and how much I weighed and how many inches I was that day. I try to stay away from the scale these days. The scale is not my friend. Because, you know, no matter what the number says, it sets me up for failure. If I'm below my weight, then woohoo, I can binge. Or woohoo, I can eat a little more. I can put a little more on my plate. And if I'm over it, well, then I'm a piece of shit. And I might as well just, you know, keep on eating. So I weigh myself only when I go to the doctor's office, and sometimes I just turn around, depending on how I'm feeling. Let's see, I want to stick to the format, and that's what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. In my mind, I've always been what I have coined a food whore. And I looked up whore in the book, and it says it's a prostitute. Now, there's also another definition for the word prostitute, and that is one who devotes her or his talents to an unworthy cause. And that's what happens to me when I take that first compulsive bite. I become that hooker on the street who's looking for her trick, or that drug addict on the corner who will do anything for their fix. I don't care about you. I don't care about the children in my classroom. I don't care about my best friend. I don't care about my partner. I don't care about nothing except where I'm going to get that next bite or that next drive-through. I just, you know, everything just goes out the window once I take that start. You know, food gave me instant gratification for a long, long, long time. And, you know, growing up, my childhood was not a dreamboat by any means, but it also wasn't the worst I've heard either. But what my childhood taught me was how to survive. I became a very good survivor. You know, so food gave me this feeling of being full and feeling loved. Sugary substances were my favorite. I've always been a really high sugar intake. You know, give me the desserts, give me the ice cream, give me the cakes, cookies, and I will talk about food because that's what this disease is about, is food. And Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about alcohol, so I'm going to talk about food. If I offend anybody, I apologize up front. I remember all the holidays by the food. You know, Thanksgiving was not about the turkey. It was about the pumpkin pie and the whipped cream on top. It was about the cinnamon cheesecake that my grandmother would make every year, you know. And Christmas was about the big shiny gold can of almond roca that I would get with a pretty gold wrapping, you know, that I would count as I ate them. And, you know, Easter was all about the Cadbury eggs, you know, a crunchy chocolate and then the filling inside. It looks really gross now that I think about it, because it did look like an egg yolk. And then, you know, think about it. And then my personal favorite was Halloween. That, to me, was the ultimate holiday, because it was free candy. You know, it was free drugs. I could go knock on doors, and you would give me my drug. And I don't know about you, but I didn't have one of those cute little pumpkins, you know, that hold about maybe two handfuls of candy. Mm-mm. I didn't have a cute little bag that you put the goblins on and you color in first and second grade. My brother and I had pillowcases. And we had big pillowcases, the extra large pillowcases. And we wouldn't go out just once. We would go out twice, three times. We would go until they would shut the door in our faces. And then we would have this whole ritual about, you know, dividing up your candy. And then we'd have to hide it because my mother, who's also a compulsive overeater, would steal it. So we'd have to find hiding places to put all our candy in. So this became a ritual for us. And I never understood how people could hang on to their Halloween candy for weeks and weeks and weeks. Mine was gone in at the most three days. And, you know, that was bartering. I would take it to school and I would barter with people. And later on, I used drugs in the same way. I became a drug dealer and kind of did the same thing as I did with candy. I'll talk about that later. So while in school, I was constantly on sugar, so I would zone out a lot. And I could remember sitting in school because a lot of stuff was happening at home, and you know, I would just feel that sugar buzz, and I would just sit there and I would zone out, and I loved that feeling. Later, you know, as an adolescent, we would do a similar thing that would kind of give me the same buzz, where you would breathe really hard, and then you'd hold your breath, and then you'd put your head back, and then you'd faint. I started doing stuff like that early on, and to me, you know, I was constantly looking for that, you know, that escape. I want to be anywhere but inside me, feeling these feelings. And later as an adult, as I said, you know, I used drugs in the same way. It was anything to escape. And I was never a fat child. My family has all been athletic. You know, I grew up playing tennis and softball, and I think that was probably the main reason why I was never obese. Because my brothers, I had three brothers, and, you know, we were always moving. Our family was very, very active. And then I remember reading about bulimia for the first time when I was about 9 years old. I distinctly remember walking to school, and I was reading a Cosmopolitan, and there was an article about, I think his name is Willie Shoemaker. I'm really dating myself. Willie Shoemaker, who was a horse jockey. And what they would do is they would go out, he and his friends, and they would get these huge steak dinners, and then they would gorge themselves, and then they'd vomit. And I thought, that's a really good idea. And I remember filing that back, you know, in my head and thinking, you know what, I might be able to use that later. And, you know, as I said, I didn't start gaining weight until in my teens. That's when it started to become a problem for me in high school. You know, go figure, puberty. So the hormones set in and started to feel a whole lot of things, and there were some things going on in my home that shouldn't have been going on, and, you know, I was stuck with all these feelings and a whole lot of rage. And the tennis and the softball and stuff wasn't working anymore. I had to do something with this rage. So I started eating. I started eating more, and then I started smoking pot, which was, you know, great because it made you laugh. But then I started eating more because, you know, everything tastes better on pot. And so in my sophomore year, I started packing on the weight. And, you know, it was very gradual. It was a couple pounds. 2 pounds became 5 pounds, and then 5 became 10. And then pretty soon, boom, by my senior year, I was up to my top weight, which was 132, which is the heaviest weight I'd ever been. And that may not mean nothing to any of you, you know, to some of you, but to a bulimic, you know, 2 pounds in my bulimic mind is like 100 pounds. It's like me looking in one of those mirrors that you see at those carnivals, you know, where your body is totally out of whack. And I started to develop such a severe self-hatred because of my weight, and I blamed everything, you know, on my weight. And so what happened is I started the yo-yo dieting. My friends were always on the diet, you know, the dieter's teas, the woman's, pregnant woman's urine. Gosh, what else did we do? You know, I don't think SlimFast was around then. Was it Slender? Yeah, the drinks, you know, all those things, which, you know, none of them, well, they all worked for about a minute. And then I discovered White Crosses, which are, you know, speed. And I really liked those because, number one, it gave me energy to clean the house. And everything was nice and neat and clean, and I liked that. And I had lots of energy. That worked for a while. But then as soon as, you know, it would wear off, then I would go on these mass binges. And then that's when I started doing the bulimia. And to me, bulimia was kind of like a power thing, because it was like a, and I'll get into what happened. It was like a like fuck you, excuse me. It was like a F you, because, you know, I could eat all this and I'm not going to gain weight. And then, you know, I could, you know, no matter how I did it and where I did it, like, I would only go to certain restaurants because they had the one stalls. I would never go to the restaurants that had more than two stalls, because then they would hear you, you know. The bulimics are shaking their head. Yes. So, you know, my life started revolving around, you know, where I could throw it, where it was convenient. You know, it just took up so much time to be a bulimic and to be a drug addict. And basically what happened is, you know, I went up and down, up and down, and if I sat down and figured out, I'd probably have gained and lost easily over 100 pounds, because I would gain 5, lose 5, gain 10, you know, lose 5, you know, just the whole up and down thing. I was anorexic for a very brief stint, for about a minute, and it was drug induced. It was because at that time I was snorting a whole lot of cocaine and crystal meth, which was wonderful for a minute. And, you know, just the whole lifestyle that I got in was, you know, drug induced, but it was short lived, thank God. So what happened finally was at 31 years old, I had had enough, and I was tired of the drugs. I was a drug dealer as well in this whole midst of things, and my best friend and I were getting high. We had just done some ecstasy. And we were sitting around. We had both just broken up with our girlfriends. I'm gay, by the way. And got married, tried that, didn't work. And so we're sitting there, and we were both just depressed as ever. And we both wanted to commit suicide. We're like, you know what? We can't do this anymore. And so she went home. I was just sitting there, and I was, you know, deep in thought, and I just started praying. You know, I said, God, you know, I got to do something here. I can't live like this anymore. And she called me back, and she said, you know, I don't know what to do, Ange, because I think, and she had been sober previously, and she said, I think I'm going to go back to AA. And I said, wow, okay, you know, maybe I'll try that too. And the next day she went, and she got involved with a group called Pacific Group, which is here in West LA, and it's a very tight run Alcoholics Anonymous program. And, you know, what I saw in her was a huge change. They swooped her up, and she got involved in that program like I've never seen her involved in anything else. And she started to change. And the next day what I did was I had to go to the dentist, and I had some wisdom teeth pulled, and I ordered, you know, he gave me a prescription of Percodan. And as soon as I went home, I called him back and said I had, my purse had been stolen so that I could get another prescription of Percodan. So that was my solution. And so I went on for another 2 weeks, you know, trying to do it Ann's way. And my friend Kathy continued to get sober. And I guess after about 2 months, I started going to AA. And after about 2 months, I saw this huge change in her. And I couldn't really explain it, but there was, she had this light in her eye that I had never seen before. And she was doing things that she'd always talked about, or that we had always talked about, and now she was actually doing them. She started going back to school. She started showing up for work. She started doing all the things that, you know, normal people do. And, you know, I was in awe of her. And so I said, okay, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And I started working the steps, and I got a sponsor, and I got really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I got sober. And what happened is after about 2 years of sobriety, I got really, really depressed. Because when I took away all the drugs, of course, I gained weight. And, you know, I started getting up there in the pounds, and self-hatred really started coming back. And I really felt disconnected from my AAers because, you know, here I was, you know, talking about serenity and working the steps and then, you know, going in the bathroom and barfing, you know. And I was feeling this huge divide, and I was also feeling this huge divide that I was lying to God, you know. And but I didn't trust that God could help me with this thing. You know, I thought that it was so petty. You know, this is just about food. I can't bother God about food. You know, and finally, I sought outside help, and I started going to a therapist, and she suggested Overeaters Anonymous, and I started going. I still couldn't get sober. And then I got highly suicidal, wanted to die, and actually went and looked at guns, and went back to my therapist, said, you know, I have to do something. I don't want to live. I can't live like this. I am just so full of self-hatred. And she said, you know, let's send you to a psychiatrist. So I went to a psychiatrist against all. I did not want to go to it because of the voices that I would hear in AA, because at that time, you know, they were like, no, you don't take anything from the waist down that affects from the waist down. To make a long story short, I went on antidepressants and felt better after about 6 weeks. And then I started going to OA. And I started to hear what was actually going on, and got real involved in OA. And that's when, you know, things started changing for me. And let's see, you know, since I got back to OA, you know, that friend of mine who got sober, stayed sober for a long term, and she got to do all those things that, you know, we talked about. She went back and she got her degree, and she got long-term sobriety, and she got the girlfriend, and she, you know, did all these things, and, you know, I started to follow in her footsteps, or I should say my footsteps, and I went back to school. And going back to school was a huge thing for me because I grew up feeling, you know, basically not very smart. The tape in my head was always, you know, you're fat, you're stupid, and you're not good enough. And so when I went back to school, I finished my degree, and then I went back and got my teaching credential. And then in 2002, I started a new job as a teacher. And the pressure of being over 45 kind of hit me. And and during this time, I've been absent for about 10 years now, back in the classroom. And then what happened in 2002 is I thought I was cured of compulsive overeating and started getting back into the bulimia. And ended up back in this room, thank God. So I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps this time around. And she suggested, and I think part of the reason why I kept failing in this program, and I also tried HOW. I don't know if anybody's tried HOW, but it was a great program. It was very rigid, but I was really grateful to it because it taught me how to eat. I don't know about you, but I didn't know what a meal was. And I certainly didn't like to eat them. My meals were, drive-thrus and on the go and, shoving things in my face in the dark, with shades drawn, watching TV. And HOW taught me, there's food groups and you don't eat between meals. You call in your food to a sponsor and, you have protein at every meal. All these things I've learned, in the 12 steps in these meetings. My abstinence currently for me is I don't throw up no matter what. That's all I can do right now. And hats off to anybody who can do perfect abstinence. God love you. There's no way I'm doing perfect abstinence now. I don't know what that is. I do the best that I can, on a daily basis. I still struggle with food. Every day, it's like that rapacious creditor that they talk about in the book, in the big book that comes out, three times a day. So they need to oil that. And I got a sponsor, worked the steps. She suggested that I, say that your abstinence should be just throwing up no matter what. And my current food plan is 3 meals a day with 2 snacks if needed. I try to stay away from sugar, but if I do eat it, not knowingly, then that's not breaking my abstinence. I still am praying for the willingness every day to give up desserts. I still have sugar-free stuff. For me, restriction doesn't work because I was so restricted growing up, and it just doesn't work for me. As far as what it's like now, I think the last time I shared here about a year ago, I shared that I was planning my wedding with my partner, and we have since gotten married and we've been together. We're in our 17th year. And to me, that's huge because my relationships, especially with people, were maximum 2 years. That was like long term for me. And to be involved with somebody, holy moly, okay, to be involved with somebody for, almost 17 years, to have an honest, healthy relationship. She's also sober and abstinent in the program is amazing to me. If you would have told me that I could accomplish all these things, by just working these steps, I would have told you, first of all, to shove it because I don't really believe you. And second of all, it would have been too much work. I have a job that most days I adore. I have friends and family that I can count on and who can count on me. I live with my partner's parents who are in their 80s. Her mother has Alzheimer's. And we take care of each other. We have this big house that we share the chores with. They're from the Depression era, so he's still fixing things with, duct tape. And I don't know what that whole thing is about, but, it's like, it's okay. They're the parents that I didn't have. I'm not to negate my parents at all because I know they did the best they could. But, they have been, for me, the window to what a normal family is all about, and that's, loving and caring. We sit down and we have dinner, a meal, every night at 6 o'clock. Well, actually, it's 5:30 now. And, we talk about our day. We listen to each other. We deeply care about each other. I have 15 nieces and nephews that we share amongst us. I was sitting there, you know, thinking about, you know, all the gifts that this program, you know, has given me in all the 12 steps, and it would take me hours. You know, I've done things in here that I just never dreamt possible, like skydive, you know, like climb mountains that to me were impossible, like, you know, running. I hate running. I run every day now, you know. My days, when I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is, you know, I read my daily meditations from my programs, and I say this angel prayer. And I get on my knees, and I say the first three steps and the seven-step prayer, and then my angel prayer. And then I take my dog for either a run or a, you know, a meditation walk. And if I don't start my day off like that, you know, if I don't do that prayer and that connection with God, thank you, you know, my day is like that VA commercial where the guy is walking, you know, sideways. And I heard, you know, an AA speaker say once that, you know, when she drank, she felt wittier, tittier, and prettier, you know, and you know, food never really did that for me, but it did numb me out, and, you know, I'm really thankful today that I don't have to, I don't look forward to getting numbed out today. Today, you know, I can't say that I look forward to certain feelings, but I know that I'm going to get through those feelings, and I'm really grateful for that. And I'm going to end with some of my favorite quotes that I've heard over the years, so I can answer some questions. One is, I have enough, I am enough, and I do enough. And be not afraid of growing slowly. Be afraid of standing still. Don't stuff your face your stuff. This is one of my favorites. But is the mating call of an asshole. I love that one. And I heard this one from a speaker once, and I could relate it to it. My mother's house is not a safe place to land, so don't keep going back to the nut house. And the last one is, I may not be perfect, but parts of me are excellent. Thank you for letting me share. Okay, questions? Yes.
Can you talk about your higher power and challenges connecting with your higher power?
Can I talk about my higher power and my challenges talking with my higher power? My higher power is awesome. When I first got sober, my second sponsor, and I've had a few sponsors, told me to write down what I want my higher power to be. And she had me do two. She had me do what I thought my higher power was, what I grew up with, and then what I wanted my higher power to be. And my first one was, you know, pretty much looked like Jesus with a robe and a beard, and was pretty much a guilt-driven God. Who judged me, who condemned me, who especially didn't accept my sexuality. So that was what I came with. And the higher power that I created was more of a goddess, but there's no gender specific for me now. It could be a guy, it could be a woman, but it's a person who, or a being that accepts me as I am, fully, completely, when I think of my higher power, I just picture white light, bright, bright, white light. And that is a pure, you know, as pure as it can get. So when I feel the darkness, you know, when I start to feel darkness, then I just think of that bright light. And whatever goes into that light is going to be pure. I don't know if that helps you. And I still struggle with the food thing as far as my higher power, because in the back of my mind, I still feel that it's a petty thing and I shouldn't bother my higher power. But that's the old God, not the new God. The new God says, oh, Anne, get over it. You haven't thrown up for almost 5 years, girl. Come on. You know, so. Yes?
Hi, I'm Corinne. Hi,
Corinne.
Everyone, thank you so much. Can you talk about, you mentioned being in multiple programs, can you talk a little bit about how you work, you know, through your program? Do you have a sponsor in each? Do you have steps in each? How does that look? How many meetings? How do you split up? You know, I struggle with that.
Great question. Her question was, being in multiple programs, how do you work multiple programs, dealing with different sponsors and working the steps? You know, this is what I struggled with before coming to this meeting. I am going to be 21 years sober this November, and I have not had a sponsor in AA. I'm in touch with a lot of my AA friends, so we kind of, you know, sponsor each other. I would not recommend that for anyone, but I had a sponsor up until my 19th year, and my sponsor died. And that was a huge thing for me. And to be quite honest, I'm very, very untrusting of people. So to ask somebody to sponsor me is a really hard thing for me, and one that I obviously need to get over. And in OA, I've had about 4 sponsors. And currently, I would say that Francine is sponsoring me because we've been sponsoring each other. That's not something that I would recommend either. But her and I have been working the steps because I think, you know, both of us have, you know, trust issues. So we thought, you know, until we both get sponsors, then we'll do it together. So hope that answers your question. Anybody else? Hey, Heather.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. No, did that say that? Yes, my abstinence is no throwing up no matter what. My food plan is no sugar, refined sugar. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to rip your head off. Yeah. Called people, wrote about it, and you know, like I said earlier, I still have sugar-free stuff, and that's something that I struggle with. And my family, you know, the one that I eat with every night, they are dessert freaks. I mean, it's all the time. You know, every night there's cake and ice cream. So, you know, it's something that I really struggle with. And I have, you know, I have my sugar-free ice cream, to be honest. I can't give that up yet. For me, I just can't. So, yeah, and when I don't, yeah, I want to rip your head off. Francine?
You had mentioned that you have ice cream, sugar-free ice cream in the house, and perhaps there are other sugar-free desserts as well that you eat. I, as a compulsive overeater, I cannot keep ice cream in my house because the portion that I'm going to eat is the container that it comes in. So how is it that you're able to take a normal portion or the portion that the manufacturer recommends?
A measuring cup. Yeah. And you know, and to be honest, you know, Francine, if I'm PMS, the measuring cup gets a little higher. You know, and I have learned that I cannot sit there and take out that ugly stick, which is what I call it, and beat myself up. You know, it's progress, not perfection. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. And I have to say that to myself all the time because my perfectionism will come in and just beat the crap out of me. So, and I don't recommend my food plan to anybody, first off. So, Yes.
Thank you so much for your share. Can you talk about the stresses of teaching? I know for me, like, and it's always been like this, between 3:30 and 5:30 are the hardest hours of the day. Do you have any strategies that have worked for you?
Well, I stopped keeping food in my refrigerator. I have a little refrigerator at my classroom. I stopped doing that. And phone calls. In the afternoon, I'll sometimes call somebody. Most of the time, I'm so busy between that time. But what does happen is meetings, you know, they always have all that junky food. I'll take an apple. You know, I have my apple. That's my exact time right there is when I'll take an apple or some nuts, you know, in the portion packages from Trader Joe's. So, yeah. Anybody else?
I'm brand new, so I guess I should identify myself now.
Welcome.
So, I'm really struggling with what to do first. People said find a sponsor. I'm having a really hard time. I know I have to stop some of my old behaviors. I would be a compulsive overeater, bulimic, but I don't know what to do instead.
Well, there's the 12 tools. Is it the 12? Eight tools. And there's phone calls, and there's a whole list. We have Mike right here can help you with a newcomer packet. And there's a whole lot of literature that is excellent. I would start getting into that book, Be a Student. You know, be a good student and start researching, you know, how do these people do this? And phone calls. You know, start calling us. Get our numbers. You know, I'd be glad to give you mine. You can call anytime. So, yeah, it's getting involved. Get commitments. And there's a whole lot of stuff. I mean, there's you're going to hear a whole lot of information. So fasten your seatbelt. It's a bumpy ride. Let me kick you in.